Hello, hello, and welcome to this episode of the Divine Downloads podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Overton. And today I have a very special guest. My beloved sister, Laura Overton, is going to be on the show. We are going to have a very candid conversation about what her experience has been like managing this crazy thing called COVID-19. So, Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here to do it.
So awesome. So it's cool to have your sister on your podcast. However, I hate that this is how we're having you on the show. And I do want to share straight up front the disclaimer. Nothing about this episode is meant to be medical advice. This is for informational purposes only. And of course, always I recommend you seek medical treatment from your primary care provider or your local ER if you're having any type of health concerns. So I want to put that disclaimer out there front and center. So really, this is just a candid conversation, because definitely if you have been watching the media, it's very abundant that there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of variation in people's experiences, and not a lot of focus has been on the management of this virus, especially at home. And so that's why I thought it would just be such a powerful episode, Laura, for you to share your experience. So let's just give people, a little reference or framework in terms of your health. So I would just ask you, well, let me just back up a second. So you have been managing both pneumonia and, we're saying, presumed COVID, because you haven't been tested. However, you have had all the symptoms and then some, right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's just talk a little bit about, of course, you don't have to share your age. Let's talk a little bit about, your health in general, and if you have any underlying medical conditions.
Absolutely. So I try to take really good care of myself. I've had a couple of challenges over the course of my life, but I think I've navigated them pretty well. Different surgeries and illnesses and things like that. I'm pretty tenacious and do the work and put the time in to allow myself to heal in whatever way I need to, physical therapy, you name it. But I was diagnosed with asthma many, many years ago, and I didn't take it too seriously in college, in my post-college education years, but I had a really great doctor, a pulmonologist in town, who explained to me what asthma really was and what it does if you aren't compliant with your inhalers and medications. So, and I didn't have a lot of money, so he actually helped me and got me samples of inhalers, because he said it was so critical to become compliant. I was a student, didn't have a lot of money. And so he really helped me and taught me how to be really good about my medication and my health in my late 20s. And so I did what he suggested, and it used to be 5 inhalers, and then it dropped down, fortunately, to 1 daily inhaler and 1 rescue inhaler. And I have not had problems with my asthma really at all for the last 18 years. So I've again tried to take really good care of myself, and I've had no real issues. I get bronchitis every so often, and I've had pneumonia a couple times in my life, both viral and bacterial. I know what that's like. I know what it feels like. It can be tough to deal with, but you just deal with it and you take care of yourself and you get better. And so that's kind of where I came. And because of that, when this thing started hitting the news in December and January, I started paying really close attention, because I hoped it wouldn't be something I'd experience, but I wanted to be ready in case it did come here, and in case it was probable that we'd be exposed to it. I wanted to be ready for it.
This is what I have shared with Laura, my sister. It's like, listen, you were either a Girl Scout or a nurse in your past life, because I'm the nurse in the family. And our mom is a nurse too. However, yeah, you are always prepared. And I have shared with my sister also that, it might behoove you to like go into disaster management, because you're so, you're so strategic and you have everything in place. So let's talk a little bit about, so well done, by the way, well done.
Thank you.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about, the length of time that you have been, we'll call it under the weather.
Sure. Okay. So as I said, I also have both my son and I are high risk because of respiratory problems. So, as an individual who's focused on taking good care of myself and also being a parent, you know, I wanted to be prepared. And so in February, when the CDC said, you know, this might be a problem here, so you may want to start taking action. You know, I did those things. I ordered a couple of masks in January, and in February, they said, you know, 2 weeks of supplies. I think it was February 26th. They said, it's probably appropriate to get 2 weeks of supplies. And if you take medications, especially daily or really important critical medications, you need to get those filled. And so I did all of that at the end of February. I started wiping things down, washing my hands all the time, and being really careful about where I went and paying attention to what I was doing through the end of February. And I had a normal week. It was pretty busy the first week of March. Being a mom and having, you know, sports and school and all kinds of activities and family things and work. And I was tired that week, but nothing out of the ordinary for me. And that weekend, which was March 7th, I had a couple of errands to run in the grocery store. And that's no big deal. I do that all the time. And that afternoon, I came home and I slept sitting up on the couch for 3 hours. The last time I'd been that tired, I had pneumonia, which was years ago. The next day, I could hardly function. I was so tired and fatigued. So that was my first symptoms, I guess, started that weekend. And I didn't really think anything about it, just other than, you know, maybe I'm just running too hard and I'm doing too much. I need to slow down and get some rest. But the next morning on Monday, March 9th, I woke up with a dry cough. And I don't usually get a dry cough for more than a day or two. And it just continued, and I got achy and the chills. I even had diarrhea. And so that first week, that's kind of how things started. And so my first symptoms, I think, would be the fatigue, the extreme fatigue. I mean, I felt like someone had drugged me. I was so exhausted, or someone had unplugged my little energy source. And that was 48 days ago. Today is day 48 from that initial onset.
Okay, I'm glad that you said that, because I was just writing down, okay, so March 7th, your first, you know, that's kind of when it, so March 9th, so now here we are, April 23rd. So I just want to give people perspective on the length of the illness. So can you speak to the range of...
Absolutely.
Let's start with the symptoms.
Okay, so one of the other things I think might be helpful for people to understand is, when this, I started reading a lot about it. And so what the things, of course, they were conveying is, have you traveled internationally? I hadn't. I'd been out of town. I'd been in California in January, but I hadn't been anywhere internationally. And certainly not, you know, anywhere even out of town in the last 30, 45 days. I didn't have a high fever. My normal body temperature is about 96.4 or 96.7, maybe 97.0. So I run really low, low blood pressure, low body temperature. And one of the factors was high fever. High fever and this travel, or international travel in particular. And so I kept thinking, I don't have any of those things. So I'm sure I just have some little bug or something. And so what happened is, over the course, and the other thing that they were not saying is that diarrhea was associated with this initially. And so I thought, well, that can't be it. I had that first week, I had a dry cough, extreme fatigue the first couple of days, and then I had 4 or 5 days of diarrhea, and I thought, well, maybe I ate something funny. You know, I continued to rationalize things, because I thought, there's no way I can have it because I don't meet the criteria that the CDC and the World Health Organization are putting out there. The other thing that happened that first couple of days, in addition to the achiness and the dry cough, I got a headache. And then a migraine, and I'm a migraine sufferer. I have been for, goodness, 25 years or so. And I try to be very careful about what I do to not have those triggers, but it's something I have to deal with all the time. And so I didn't think anything about that either. but I lost my voice. I went hoarse. I don't know. This is hoarse. I'm kind of in and out of hoarseness. That's the word. And then I started wheezing a little bit, like an asthmatic wheezing. And I thought, oh, okay, this is kind of strange. And then it just continued. And eventually, by the end of that week, I had a fever. And I don't know for sure what it was, because I had 3 thermometers in my house and I couldn't get any of them to work. So I didn't have the batteries, and one of them kept reading and then it would disappear and it wasn't reading correctly. So I didn't know. So again, that was, I didn't have a fever, at least a high fever. So I kept thinking that this can't be COVID. I'm sure it's just a regular old virus or some bad cold or something. And then I think I talked to you late in that first week and said, you know, I'm coughing around the clock. I mean, it was constant. I'm hoarse. People would call me on the phone and they're like, what is wrong with you? I'm like, oh, I just have a little bug or a little cold, no big deal. And I called you, I think on Friday I was concerned. And then Saturday, I think I called you and said, something's just not right. I don't feel good at all. And this is like nothing I've really experienced before. You know, what should I do? And so you helped me on that Saturday, the 14th of March. So literally 7 days from my first symptom of fatigue, I called the telehealth number that you gave me and was diagnosed. I did a virtual screening with them and was diagnosed with a viral upper respiratory infection, also known as the cold. And what they told me is, we don't think you have COVID because you haven't been out of the country, you don't have a high fever, diarrhea is not one of the symptoms. You know, it was basically what they knew at the time, which wasn't very much. And so they said, I said, well, what should I do? Is there anything I should take? And they said, well, you can take some Tylenol, but rest is the most important thing. Lots of fluids and rest. There's really nothing that you can take. You could take something if you want for your symptoms, but we don't really recommend anything. And because you have asthma, we recommend you limit your activities and don't leave the house unless you really need to. And I was like, oh, okay. And the day before, things were happening nationally, internationally, and even in our own state. You know, President Trump declared a national emergency, and our governor, Tim Walz, had decided that there was also, a state emergency in our state. And so I had already decided that some things probably needed to change at our house and in my behavior. And I didn't want to expose myself to anybody else on the rare chance that I might have this virus or some other virus, the flu or something else. And I also thought it was best, if I am sick, not to expose myself to other people, because my immune system is obviously compromised. Something's going on. So I'd be more likely to get COVID, I thought, if I went out, or pneumonia or the flu or something. So I had made a decision the night before that I was going to not leave my house anymore for the foreseeable future. So, and you again put me in touch with the telehealth people on the 14th. And so my son and I stayed home and we did virtually nothing as far as interaction outside. We did walk outside to the park, but we really didn't do anything. And then I started getting worse, lots of coughing, hoarse, and that Sunday and Monday. And then Tuesday afternoon, I took a walk, and a short walk, and I thought, my chest hurts, and I really don't feel very well. It almost feel like I pulled muscles in my chest, you know, or tweaked something, or just did something funny to the muscles in my chest. And I thought, well, that's strange, but I had moved some things in the house that day, and so I just chalked it up again, rationalizing it to something else, but that's what it was. And then by that night, intense coughing, lots and lots of coughing, and then chest pain. At first it was just muscular, felt sore, a little strained, irritated, and then the pain started that night. And then I had chest pain, intense chest pain, and it just continued on the next day, the 18th, and I felt it like low in my lungs. And I've had bronchitis and pneumonia before, I know what those feel like, and this felt very different. And it felt really low. And then on the next day, on Wednesday, the 18th, I started having trouble breathing. And I was like, huh, it was just difficult to take a deep breath. And, you know, I've done yoga, I do the mindfulness thing. I listen to meditation. I try to practice the meditation. And so I really tried to focus on my breathing. And the other thing I had was, I also had a couple of muscle, like low back, upper back and low back muscle spasms and just aching that, again, I've had some issues, you know, other medical challenges before. And I have pain periodically in places, but nothing like this. It was just really strange and unique. And so the next day I was achy all over my body. And then the breathing and the pain just got worse and worse and worse. And so on the 19th, I called in to telehealth again. And I had trouble talking. I told them my symptoms. I told them about my original diagnosis of the upper respiratory viral infection. And that I've been resting and doing fluids, but it was getting harder to breathe and very painful in the chest. And so they prescribed a Z-Pak for me. And I had a discussion with them because they determined, and again, it's just via telehealth, so nobody examined me in person. And they determined that I had pneumonia. And they said, we also believe you're presumed COVID. But earlier in that week, the state of Minnesota had made the change where you couldn't be tested anymore. I think for about a week or two, you could be tested. Just anybody could be tested if they went in. But now it was only for if you've been, not even if you're in the ER, but if you're hospitalized, if you're a healthcare provider, or I think, you know, EMS, fire police, you know, any kind of healthcare provider, or somebody who could assist others, which of course makes sense, and then congregate living. And it's been the case ever since. And so they said, we can't test you for COVID, but you sound like you definitely have COVID, and we need to treat you like you have COVID. So even if you got diagnosed and tested for COVID right now, it wouldn't change our recommendations. It would be the same. And they didn't want me to go into urgent care or the ER and wanted me to try the azithromycin. And my understanding is that that is an antibiotic for bacterial infections. And my understanding was that COVID was a viral infection. So I didn't understand why they were putting me on an antibiotic for a bacterial. And so we had a long discussion about it. They were fantastic. And they explained that what they've been seeing in the various countries and various patients is that this virus creates or causes, I should say, bacterial pneumonia. And it's dangerous, and people get hit with it, and then what is the word I want to use? Go spiraling down quickly. So what they had been doing was not giving antibiotics initially because of the viral aspect, but decided to start with this more aggressive approach. And so I got that, and I was told, kind of off the record, that things would be moving pretty quickly in Minnesota, and that people who were presumed COVID could go to a specially designated ERs, or excuse me, urgent cares. And they were trying to get that worked out. So I couldn't go anywhere yet. They told me to sit and wait at home. That was the safest place for me. And I also didn't want to go anywhere in the event I didn't have it. I didn't want to expose myself to this or the flu and get sick when I didn't even have it. So that happened on the 19th. And then on the 20th, one of the things I started doing, because they asked me when I called at the telehealth place on the 19th, they asked me how much I weighed, you know, what's your temperature and all my symptoms. And so I started weighing myself that day. And I started, you were kind enough to give me your thermometer. So I started taking my temperature multiple times a day, and I started recording it on just a little paper calendar. And then the next day on the 20th, it got worse. And a little bit of comic relief. There's quite a bit of that in this situation. And they only called in one day of the Z-Pak. I was supposed to get 5 days, and I only got one day, which I thought was strange. So we had to get another prescription. So you went to the pharmacist for me twice in 24 hours to get the full medication. So I took that. But my intensity of difficulty breathing increased. The tightness and pain in my chest increased, and the achiness in my back really, really came back even more intensely that day. And then also for this second week, I had diarrhea every three or four days of this week. I also had diarrhea. So like all of my systems were starting to get really upset and not performing. And so, the next day was the 21st. The other thing they told me on the 19th, because I was presumed COVID, that I needed to start checking in every single day with the on-care people. And so I checked in on the 20th. They told me to steady the course and keep doing what I was doing. And the next day, when I talked to the on-care telehealth people, I was much, much worse Saturday the 21st. And they said, you need steroids. So they put me on prednisone. They also said, we really want you to go to urgent care. But there were only three urgent cares I was allowed to go to. Two were about to close within 30 minutes of my on-care telehealth visit. And one was going to be open a little later. But again, I was terrified to go because I didn't want to expose myself or anybody else in the event I had it. I didn't want to get it if I didn't already have it. So they told me to get the prednisone. And if I was not feeling better by the next day, I had to go to the urgent care because I was so sick. So the next day on Sunday the 22nd, it felt like a boa constrictor had wrapped around my chest, my lungs. It felt as though my ribs were going to break for a couple of days. I would say at least 4 days, 3 days. It felt like a boa constrictor was just tightening and tightening and tightening the grip. And it wasn't just the upper chest for me. Whenever I've had pneumonia and bronchitis before, that's where it's been tough and felt hard to breathe. But this was lower down in my lungs, my diaphragm area. And I'd never really experienced anything like that before. And I went to urgent care and they told me that I could hardly talk. I don't know if you remember this, but I could hardly get out a sentence or two. I had to continuously, it was something like this. Well, I need to go, you know, and I was taking breaths between, you know, I couldn't even get the sentence out. I felt like the sloth at the DMV and the Zootopia movie. It was just like, can't get a sentence out. And so I met with a great nurse practitioner at urgent care, and she said, your coughing is terrible. She couldn't even get breath sounds to tell me anything. She said, I definitely think you have pneumonia and COVID. You know, we can't test you again. We're so sorry. They wanted to do a chest x-ray that day, but the x-ray tech went home with a COVID diagnosis about an hour before I got there. So I didn't get a chest x-ray. But they decided that I needed 5 additional drugs to complement the cocktail of drugs that I was already on, the azithromycin and the prednisone. So she prescribed me 2 medications for a nebulizer. And then cough medicine, because she said, you have to stop coughing. You're coughing. Your body can't handle this much coughing. Your chest muscles, you're going to fatigue yourself out, and it's going to cause you even more difficulty trying to breathe. So she gave me a cough medication, and they put me on a new antibiotic called doxycycline hyclate. And she said, that's pretty much the gold standard. And she said, that's what we do for pneumonia. She said, either it's the azithromycin or the doxycycline. And that was a 10-day course. My azithromycin was a 5-day course. So, and the nebulizer was something that I guess on the second or third day that I was having trouble breathing and chest pain, one of my good friends, Teresa, and you both said, you need a nebulizer, Laura, you know, because I was already using my rescue inhalers, my albuterol rescue inhaler, and it was doing nothing. And I was using my daily Symbicort inhaler, which is more long-term anyway. And I was getting no relief. And so both of you really encouraged me to be an advocate about, and I'm pretty knowledgeable, unfortunately, or fortunately, because of all the things I've been through over time, health-wise. So I know enough probably to be dangerous about what to ask for and advocate for myself. But obviously, you know, you and other family members have helped educate me on what to ask for and the questions to pose to the medical professionals, which has been really helpful for me. So, but both of you said, you've got to demand a nebulizer. And so I called before I got to urgent care and said, this is what I believe I need. I need you to get me one. And I thought they'd give me one there, but because of the, what is it called, Elizabeth? The aerosolization?
Yes.
What is it?
Yes.
Yeah. So normally what in a normal world, non-COVID situation, you go to an urgent care or an ER, often they would let you do the nebulizer. They would do a nebulizer treatment for you at urgent care. And you sometimes wouldn't even need to get your own nebulizer machine. But because this virus is so contagious, they prohibit that everywhere right now. And so she said, and also you're so gravely sick that you need your own nebulizer and you need to be doing it every 4 hours for the next 10 days, 24 hours a day. I don't care if it's 3 a.m, 2 a.m, you need to set your alarms. You need to be doing it every 4 hours. And if you do not get relief within the next, 8 hours or so, you need to go directly to the emergency room. So that was, if you're looking at the timeline from my first symptom of fatigue, which was the 7th, 10 days later is when the chest pain and difficulty breathing started. And it was 8 days from my first day of coughing, the dry cough. And it was 15 days when I ended up in urgent care, it was 15 days from my initial symptoms. And I mentioned this briefly before, when I was diagnosed with pneumonia and presumed COVID on the 19th, they said they wanted to send me to somewhere that day because they thought I should be seen that day in person to have my lungs, what do you call it, Elizabeth? Auscultated. Auscultated, thank you, the auscultated, and to get a chest x-ray and just an overall physical exam, but they couldn't because I was presumed COVID and they wouldn't let me go anywhere. So I had to wait. You actually have to wait for permission to go to urgent care. I'm sure a lot of people don't know that who haven't been before. And so I had to wait for them to open up these urgent care clinics specific to COVID people. And then I had to, once that happened, which I believe happened on Friday night, the 20th, the night of the 20th. And then I had to wait for them to give me approval to go through the urgent care or the on care telehealth organization. And so there was a couple of days of lag that I think that for me, it's a situation we're dealing with something that no one has ever dealt with before. It's so complicated. I think everybody's doing the absolute best they can in the medical community, in our government, all these different people trying to help figure this out as quickly as possible and utilizing what they already know to try and learn as quickly as they can about this virus and adapting to individual patients and general protocols and approaches for what works. And so for me, it was a little tough because I felt like there were a couple of days there where I got really bad, really sick, really quickly. And for me, I wish I'd been able to get in a little sooner, but I understand. And also my personality a little bit is, oh, I'll be fine. Let's just ride it out and see. But it became incredibly clear to me that I was very, very sick, dangerously sick. And so I started the another comic relief thing, but not really. I thought I was going to have a heart attack because I was so upset about it and stressed about it. But when the nurse practitioner who was so helpful for me at urgent care called in the prescriptions, she forgot to put in a prescription for the nebulizer machine itself. So I got the 5 medications and the urgent care was closing at, I believe, was it 7 o'clock that night? 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock that night. So the pharmacist, you were at the pharmacy picking up all of my medications yet again. I mean, you were there 4 days in a row, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Now it's nighttime and the urgent care is about to close and the pharmacist gets on the phone and calls urgent care. She sat on the phone, I think, on hold for 45 minutes. I also called. She called me. We talked together, and we both also waited on hold for almost 45 minutes to try to get someone at that urgent care to get the nurse practitioner to actually call in a prescription for the nebulizer. And so I didn't know what I was going to do, because if she left and no one called in the prescription, that meant I was not going to have it that night. And I was afraid I may not make it that night. I mean, she said, you are so gravely sick. You have to have this. You have to start getting this into your lungs. And if not, you need to go to the ER. So my next step would have been going directly to the ER that night if we hadn't gotten that machine. But fortunately, 5 minutes before they closed, I talked to a nurse at the urgent care, God bless her. And she said, I will not leave here until we get this taken care of for you, because the nurse practitioner I talked with was gone. So kudos to her, because she went above and beyond, this other nurse, above and beyond that night to take care of me. I think she heard the desperation in my voice and also the pharmacist's. So you were able to pick up the nebulizer for me, and I started doing it that night. And I continued to do it Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So for 7 days, I did it. And I did it every 4 hours. I started, of course, as I said, jotting down my weight, my symptoms every day, and my temperature, my body temperature. And then I started taking a selfie of myself every time I did the nebulizer, just to make sure I did it within the increments. And I also set alarms on my phone. And the other thing that you had taught me was, because you had FaceTime me, is my coloring. You know, was I pink or was I starting to turn a little blue or purple? And so I'd take a picture for that purpose too, to make sure when I wasn't, because I didn't, you know, we weren't interacting all the time, that I was the right color. And then the other thing that, you know, was really helpful that you did for me is ordered an oximeter for me. You immediately said, we have to start monitoring your oxygen levels, because my oxygen levels weren't great. Apparently the real danger zone is 92, they told me. And so I continued on the course. I took all the medications. And all during this time, I was in bed probably 20 hours a day. I was thinking it was 4 weeks, but I think it was maybe 3.5 or 4 weeks. I was so fatigued, so incredibly sick, that all I could do was get up to go to the bathroom, and I couldn't breathe, or my heart rate would go up, or I'd go get some fluids or a little bit of food, and I'd come back upstairs and I was fatigued. And so I was literally in the bed. I didn't do anything. I couldn't even really sit up. And I got thrush during this time in my mouth, a yeast infection in my mouth from all of the medications and the nebulizers, I presume, mostly. One of the other things that happened is I had developed tachycardia, which I'll probably mess this up, but it's an increased heart rate over an extended period of time. Is that right, Elizabeth? Is that how you define it?
Yeah, so tachycardia just means that you're, you know, your heart rate is elevated.
Yeah. So I was on 5 different kinds of steroids, which if any of you have been on steroids before, it can make you feel like you're going to jump out of your skin. You can't sleep. It also apparently really can mess with your heart rate. And so my heart rate, I think normal is around 77. Elizabeth and I concluded that lots of my numbers are low, and so my resting heart rate is probably lower. We do, I think it's about 65 to 67 now that I'm better, a little better. But my heart rate was getting to like 112, 113, 115, 199. And it did that for, I want to say it was at least 10 days around the clock. And that was another complication I wasn't expecting, or a symptom I wasn't expecting to experience. And so urgent care was on the 22nd, started nebulizers the night of the 22nd, these 5 other medications. And by Thursday of that week, I was not doing very well. I was still having significant trouble breathing. My heart was racing. I was having abdominal pain. On the left side, tons of chest pain and pressure. Around that time, I also lost my sense of smell and taste. You brought some beautiful lilies over to me, dropped them off at my front door, and they're an incredibly aromatic flower. And the entire time they were in my house for probably 10 days, I never could smell them at all. Couldn't taste food, couldn't smell anything. So that was something that also developed around this time, this is now 19 days in. And about 9 days from when the chest pain and the difficulty breathing started. So those were kind of, I guess, my symptoms. So that day, I ended up going to the emergency room. I did not want to go, but I was afraid that I may not survive if I stayed home another day, because I couldn't sleep at night. I was going to bed at 4:35 in the morning. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't breathe. And I was afraid, you know, I literally closed my eyes and said, please let me wake up the next morning, because I just didn't know. There was probably about a 7-day period where I was concerned that I was not going to make it. I tried, you and mom and others said, stop reading anything about this. And the main reason I wanted to read things online was because I think I called you, Elizabeth, and maybe even texted mom and dad and Anne and Jerry, saying, can someone please research this and tell me what the symptoms are? What, like, where's the real distress? Like, how do you know when you're about to fall off the cliff? Because how close am I, you know, or am I already going over the cliff and I just don't even know it yet? You know, what, I don't want to miss anything, and I don't want to rush in and be somewhere and ask for care that's not necessary, and someone else could be getting the care instead of me that's worse than I am. But I didn't know how bad it had to be to ask for that help and to get that care. And that's another reason I went to the emergency room. And when I went to the emergency room, it was like an episode out of a sci-fi movie. The whole campus was closed. I've been to this ER twice before in the last 2 years, and it was a ghost town. And I was the only patient I saw. I had to go in a separate entrance, and I was escorted, and I was put in an isolation room in the ER. I thought there'd be all these people waiting, you know, all these sick people lined up, and it wasn't. I thought it'd be chaotic. It wasn't. It was quiet, calm, eerily calm and quiet. No beeping of machines, no interaction, no noise, nothing. And they put me in an isolation room in the ER. And then I had to take my own temperature and do my own pulse ox, my own oxygen and pulse. And they read it from the other side of the glass. And then I had to talk on an iPad via video conference with the providers. And they said my oxygen looked good enough to go home. They said, you know, we're not going to admit you with your oxygen level. This is good. You're really, really sick, but there's nothing we can really do for you. And you're better off at home than you are here. Because if you stay here, you could get, you know, exposed to something more, and you don't want to be here if you can avoid it. And so they gave me 2 Tylenol, and I said, can you please tell me, where am I? And that chart that I had been keeping, I did an actual calendar, and I wrote down my symptoms. I highlighted my symptom days, the number of days, highlighted all of my symptoms, my body weight, everything, and I took that with me to the ER so they could see where I was. And I said, can you tell me where I am in the timeline? You know, have you seen asthmatics? Have you seen people who are on my timeline with my symptoms? You know, how many more days of this do I have? Or, you know, how much worse am I going to get? Or am I going to start getting better today or tomorrow? And they said, we're so sorry, but we can't tell you. We don't know. We have no idea. And they said, this is what you need to do. You need to start monitoring your oxygen. And I said, oh, with an oximeter? And they said, yes. Do you have one? And I told them you had ordered me one. And they said, oh my goodness, that's fantastic. You need to continue monitoring your temperature and take your use the oximeter to take your pulse and your oxygen reading every single day, multiple times a day. And if it gets to 92 and stays there, not just one dip, it gets to 92 and stays there for a number of readings, you need to immediately return, because that is very dangerous. And we hope we don't have to, but we probably have to put you on, you know, oxygen and a ventilator. And I said, okay, is there anything else? And they said, no, just do what you're doing. And I said, okay. And they said, well, that's all we can tell you. And they said, good luck. And someone walked me all the way down the long corridor to the door. And I thought, I'm never coming back. I don't want to ever be back. It was so scary. And they couldn't help me. You know, there's nothing they could do for me. And I decided, it was the shortest visit ever. It was less than an hour, but it was hard. I didn't want to go. I was scared to go. I was scared of what they were going to tell me. I also was very upset when I left. I mean, I wasn't showing it, but I had to say goodbye to my son, and I told him I'd be back soon, but I didn't know if I was ever going to get to see him again. I was that sick. I felt that horrible, and I didn't know if they were going to admit me, if they were going to just monitor me for a while, or if they were going to admit me and, you know, put me on oxygen, or worse, a ventilator or something like that. I just had no idea what to expect. And it was especially hard because on the 19th, when I was diagnosed with pneumonia and COVID, I was told to isolate from him in our house. And so I had been away from him, and we're still in the same house, but I was in the upstairs and he was in the downstairs. We have separate parts of the house where our bedrooms are and separate bathrooms. And so I was told to wear a mask and gloves at all times when I left my bedroom, but to not leave my bedroom unless I had to go to the bathroom or get some food or drink out of the kitchen. So we would talk to each other by phone to tell each other when we're going to be in the kitchen or interacting. And so I couldn't even give them a hug when I left. And one of the things I've certainly heard about with lots of people in their stories is that it's such a lonely experience. It's an incredibly scary experience, but it's also a very lonely feeling because you can't be around the people. Like you haven't been in my house since early March. You know, I haven't been able to give you a hug or, you know, or sit next to you or, you know, your family or, you know, even my son or any of my other family. We have family here and none of them have, you know, really been able to interact with us. And so it's a very isolating thing. I mean, I know everybody's home under stay-at-home orders and shelter-in-place orders, and it's tough, but having to isolate from your family members and to be I'm a single mom, it's just me. So all the chores around the house and those sorts of things had to fall to him. And so it was just really hard that day because I thought I was trying to keep my positive attitude up and tell him, you know, I'll be back in a little while. Love you. Across the garage, you know, he couldn't be near me. I couldn't hug him. And I was trying to stay positive and strong for him, but I was terrified that I didn't know when I could see him again or ever. And that was not a pleasant experience. So I was grateful when I came home, but I was also a bit scared because I thought these people, as trained as they are, don't know what's going to happen to me and they can't tell me if I'm going to get better. I mean, I asked them point blank, I'm like, do you think I'm going to make it? Do you think I'm going to fight? Can I beat this? What? And they said, we cannot tell you. We have no idea. And that was a bit unnerving for me to not have any kind of real guidance or knowledge about how many more days or how many more of this you can do until you feel better or until you beat this. And we don't even know if you're going to be able to beat this. So just do the best you can. And here's some Tylenol. It was really rough. And so anyway, I know you were asking about the symptoms, but that's kind of the lead up to that, why it got so bad. And again, the next day and the next day, my pulse was still really, really high and I was still having trouble breathing. And so in consultation with you and the other medical members of our family and just my own, how I felt, I was afraid, you know, one of the other things I've been reading is that some people have heart issues and I know I'll say it wrong, heart attack or myocardial infarction or something, distress with their heart. I was concerned about that as well. And so I made the decision that Saturday after 7 days of doing the nebulizer every 4 hours that I was going to try and not do it for a couple of hours at least to see if I could get my heart rate to a more normal level. But then I continued, you know, to use my rescue inhalers and the nebulizers a little bit off and on. And then the chest pain, by the way, did change. So the first probably 6 to 7 days, it felt like a boa constrictor wrapped around my chest, both the top of my lungs all the way down to the bottom. And then eventually it changed to feeling like a baby elephant sitting on my chest with the breathing, difficulty breathing and getting a breath and the pain. And then eventually I experienced some other symptoms. I experienced, by the way, 31 different symptoms and about 3 different kinds of chest pain. And I say different kinds because they felt very, very differently and they occurred at different times during this process. So the next thing I experienced was the next week. And it was more of a pressure. So I still had chest pain, but it wasn't that crushing, thought my ribs were going to break multiple days in a row. It was more of a pressure and just really uncomfortable feeling. And then it felt like that in my esophagus. And I, unfortunately, 7 years ago, suffered an anaphylactic shock situation. Is that what you say? Anaphylaxis. Sorry, not anaphylactic shock. Anaphylaxis. And was rushed to HCMC and barely made it, from what I understand, getting there. I think they said about 2 more minutes and I'd have to been intubated, I guess. So I know what it feels like to have your throat swell and your esophagus swell up. And that's what it felt like to me. It was a very unsettling feeling. And it felt like somebody had taken their chest or their fist and put it right in the middle of my chest, right between my breasts, just like punched me right there and left their fist there in just continuous pressure. And so I had been checking in with OnCare people and every day, and my heart rate was still up. I still had tachycardia. And so there's some discussion in our family and also with the on-care people about whether I should go get an EKG and an echocardiogram to make sure I didn't have any damage to my heart, my heart muscle, or any kind of sinus rhythm issues. And the doctor I spoke with said, no, I think you're not high enough for that. Let's just monitor you, see how you're doing. And he made a referral to something that I'd never heard before called the Well Loop, which is a daily online, I fill out a survey similar to OnCare, but it's like I'm assigned a case. And so I have the same team of people checking on me every day. And so I let them know what was going on. And starting on the 30th, they put me in this system, which I have had amazing. Sometimes I haven't gotten as much detail as other days because there isn't a lot they can tell me other than stay the course. But I've spoken with a number of doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, and even medical students, and I've gotten a lot of great information, and I highly recommend it for anybody that's going through this because, again, it's just me at home by myself, and I don't know what I don't know, and I don't know necessarily what to ask. And I had to become my own advocate, you know, my best advocate, and really tell them in detail. And they told me the other day, you have incredibly documented information and we're so grateful. You're a good patient because you really tell us all the details. We can really help you because you're helping yourself. You're really paying attention to your symptoms, the duration, and all the things we need to know to better help you. So that's something I definitely, you know, think is a good idea for people who are going through it. So I guess then after that, it continued for a whole nother, you know, I had abdominal pain, I had throat pain, I had, it felt like swelling. I started taking Benadryl just in case I was having some sort of reaction with respect to histamines or something like that. One of the things that they have told me now that they know much better is that yes, it's a respiratory situation, but it really affects all of your systems in your body. And so for me, they said that's definitely the case. Again, I've had 31 different symptoms in multiple systems in my body. And this thing it's like a beast. It has taken full-on attack mode on my body and been unrelenting. And so, you know, we're now here at day, you know, this is the next week and we're in day 26, 27, 28, and I'm still having fevers every couple of days. I'm still having difficulty talking. I'm hoarse. You know, I still have a lot of those same symptoms and pressure in my throat, esophagus, chest. I kept thinking there are a couple of days where I sat outside for an hour or two the week after I was in the ER and thought, oh, wow, I'm getting better. And then I would just crash. And, you know, it continued. It was like a roller coaster with lots of really scary drops and then shoot back up situations. And so I continued to monitor all my symptoms, continue weighing myself, you know, doing the same thing. And I kept thinking, okay, I'm going to be better next week or tomorrow. It's going to be gone. And it continued to just hold on. And I don't know they couldn't believe it. They're like, you were so sick for so long. And so, as I said, you know, today is day 48. And I was back in urgent care on Monday for an EKG and a chest x-ray because I've still been having chest pain and hoarseness and difficulty with my breath and breathing in and out. And one of the things they thought for the last couple weeks is that perhaps I broke a rib or two because I've been coughing for so long. I coughed from, you know, March 9th to the last day that I had consistent 24-hour kind of coughing was April 14th. So that's 39 days of coughing. And I did cough medicines and I did cough drops and I did, you know, honey in my tea. I drank bone broth. I drank, you know, I did all these things to try and minimize the coughing, but it kept on. And so what they concluded for me is that I damaged my chest wall. And Elizabeth, you can certainly speak more to the medical and anatomical ways of describing it. But I got a chest x-ray on Monday and the EKG came out, fortunately, good. My sinus rhythm was good. There's no evidence of damage to, I didn't have an enlarged heart and I didn't have any irregular rhythm. And one of the reasons, again, that we're concerned about it is because I'd had tachycardia for so long and I was having still so much chest pain, and they were concerned about the chest pain because it was so intense and so difficult to breathe or move around. They wanted to rule that out. And the other thing that they had told me to do, actually one of my friends suggested it, and then the doctor I spoke with on March 30th encouraged me to do it if I could, was get a little EKG monitor. And so I just had one of those little, I ordered it online, I got it last week. You just put your fingers on it to check it. And so my rhythms, my sinus rhythm, I should say, not my rhythms, my sinus rhythm didn't look really normal in my opinion based on what I was reading, but it kept saying no arrhythmia is detected. But it also said, but this can't determine if you had a heart attack or have other issues. And so again, I just went in just to make sure, because I was having so much chest pain and some other issues that they thought may indicate possible issues with my heart. So so that was just this past Monday, I did that. And it turns out I didn't break any ribs, so that's really good. But I damaged the chest, my chest wall, and my lungs. They said my lungs are damaged and my chest wall is damaged, but these are all things that I will recover from. And one of the surprising things that the doctor told me on Monday was that they really don't know how long you're contagious, and it really depends on the individual and the severity of the case and really how much viral load you carry. And some people apparently are carrying a high viral load with either without any symptoms at all or before they really start experiencing symptoms, and then it diminishes. And then there are other people who have symptoms, pretty intense symptoms, and carry those symptoms for a pretty long time, like me. I'm a good example of that, I guess. And so your viral load can be heavier throughout that longer period of time. So I was advised to continue quarantining, and I may have to quarantine even after our stay-at-home order is lifted here in Minnesota. And so that was a little bit of a surprise to me that I could still be contagious. And that was on day 45. So that really surprised me. And also, you know, she did say that because my immune system has been, you know, hit pretty significantly, I'm also more susceptible to the flu and other viruses right now. So it just makes sense for me to stay home and protect myself. So I guess that's it. So the other thing is the fatigue, and I'm still not sleeping very well. I thought for sure I'd be a rock star by now and have all kinds of energy and be able to do things. And I'm really surprised at how long it's been taking just to get some energy. And the other thing that she said is that she thinks that my journey has been a lot longer because I have asthma. And we talked about the fact that I'd had no real issues for 18 years or so. And she said that's what they've been seeing, is people with respiratory issues, asthma included, if you get hit with it and you do have a negative response, it's a pretty long response. So she told me that it's probably going to be another 30 days at least until I feel, quote, normal. And that was a little hard to hear, but I have resolved to do everything I can to make myself as healthy as possible and recover. But they told me, I forgot to mention this, they told me, I think it was April 6th, that I was finally stable and out of the woods. And so that was, again, the chest pain and the difficulty breathing and the crushing kind of chest pain started around, it was the night of March 17th. So that was 20 days later is when they told me I was finally stable. And Elizabeth, you let me know what your thoughts are on this, but my understanding when I talked to the doctors was that that meant they didn't think I was going to fall off the cliff anymore and that I was going to make it.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
With that statement. And here's the thing, as your sister and as a nurse, I know the only thing that you needed in that moment when you drove yourself to the ER was for someone to look you in the eye and say, you know what, you're going to be fine. And I knew that they weren't going to be able to tell you that. And that was the hardest, hardest thing to witness. And so I want to say thank you for keeping copious amounts of detail, because this conversation is going to help give people a frame of reference. I think if you take 100 people, and of course, everybody that comes to the table has a different medical history. You know, there have been people that are athletes, to people that have asthma, to, you know, multiple chronic conditions. So the symptoms are extremely varied, as your case is a quintessential example of. And the thing that I think you so poignantly represent is you absolutely have to be an advocate for yourself. And so now you are an attorney. That is your wheelhouse. And so you're very into the minutiae of the details. And so it's probably a blessing and a curse that you're so detailed, right? Because you shared a boatload of detail. And for some people, it's like, I don't freaking know. And as a nurse, I have always told people, the care that you are going to receive is dependent upon what type of historian you are. Meaning, you know, people will tell you, keep a journal, keep a log, keep your symptoms. Like, when people are vague, it's hard to nail down. We can only treat people based on what we know, right? And a lot of people don't tell the full story, like whether right. that be, oh, but I also smoke on the side and I do this on the side. So, like, you know, supplements, healthcare people need the full story. So I want to acknowledge you for your detail, your resilience, your tenacity, because you're obviously not a quitter. And I want people to hopefully receive some hope from this. So let's just dive a little bit in, just for the sake of time, because it's been a little bit, we're a little over an hour. So I want to follow up by asking you a couple questions. And that would be, what's one thing that you wish you knew before you'd gotten sick?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think, as you touched upon, I am an attorney. That is my profession. So everything I look at is has a tint of prevention, preparation, and that sort of thing. But one thing that I wasn't prepared for and caused a lot of stress for some of my most difficult days is that I have a will, I have a power of attorney, and I have a healthcare directive. But they hadn't been updated since my little boy was born, and he's 13. And so, I was married, I'm divorced now. And so, it was on my list of things to do. And nobody likes to think about these dire situations where you have to think about if you're in the hospital and you can't talk because someone has put you on a ventilator. I mean, I don't know if people understand what that process is like. They give you a paralytic and there's no communication usually. I mean, you can't communicate whatsoever. And so, as much as I am prepared all the time, I hadn't taken that step. There's been a lot of other things going on, and we'd moved, and there was so much that had happened, and it was on my list, but I just hadn't done it. And so I had so many friends texting me saying, Laura, you are so sick. Why are you not in the emergency room? One of them was fear, because as you said, I wanted them to tell me I was going to make it and I was going to be okay. And I was afraid that they were going to say either I wasn't or they didn't know. The other, I was afraid if I didn't have COVID, I was entering into a very scary and vulnerable place where I could get it or I could get flu or whatever. But the other reason was I did not want to show up and have them take action and put me in, you know, in a medical situation where I had nobody. It's hard to be a single parent, just generally. There's no other adult in your house to help you. And then when it comes to like legal things and, oh my goodness, your health care, I thought, what am I going to do? I have to get this done. And so I wish I'd done that beforehand. And I recommend to everybody, if you don't have this, because in a normal situation, you go into the hospital, they ask you, do you have a health care directive? Do you have a power of attorney? Is there someone who can speak for you? Like, you're not married, or you don't have someone. they need to know who is that. Because if you pick up the, you know, for instance, you, if you call the hospital, they're not going to give you most of my medical information, and they're sure not going to let you make medical decisions for me. Like, okay, put her on a ventilator. Okay, take her off the ventilator. Okay, yes, this is what she wants. Yes, this is not what she wants, without some sort of legal document or proof that you have that authority. And so that's something I really wished I'd done, that I hadn't, because that also delayed me a couple of days, because I kept thinking I'm not really that sick. And then as the days progressed, I thought I better get my affairs in order, because I don't want to leave my family. I don't want to leave my son with all of this uncertainty. So one of, in addition to calling my attorney and saying, please, I'm so sorry to be asking you this, but can you expedite this process? I am very sick and I need help right now. And she did it. I talked to her on a Monday. She had everything done on Wednesday. The only reason that didn't happen on Wednesday is because I was so sick Wednesday that I couldn't even physically look at the documents and review them and figure out who's going to witness and all that. So I wish I'd done that. The other thing that I had started thinking about doing when I first got sick, just in case, and I thought I was being overly prepared and a little worrisome, and I didn't want to will it into being. But again, being on my own, it was creating lists for my son, even my dog. You know, where does my dog go to the vet? Where does my son go to the doctor? Where are our bank accounts? Where are the important documents in our home? And I have a safe, I have safety deposit boxes and that sort of thing. But here are the passwords to our security code. Here are the passwords to my phone and my laptop. Here's all the information, you know, that you need for my child. Here's the information you need for me. Here are my wishes. So I quickly, in those days when I was really sick, had to think about those things. And that added an additional level of stress and uncertainty that I wished I didn't have to go through during that time. So those were two things that I really recommend and encourage. I wish I'd been more prepared, and I was pretty prepared. I mean, I'd ordered a mask. I was starting to quarantine myself, isolate myself. I had supplies. I had done all of that, but I hadn't done the really, I think, critical things, because one of the things that this situation creates from everything I'm reading and in my own experience is you don't feel so good, and then you feel like you're not going to make it. And that is a really quick dive. There isn't a really big ramp up period for that, or I guess a preparation time for that. And so I wish I had better appreciated that, because I kept thinking, I don't have all these issues these other people have, and I've been really careful. And so it's not going to happen to me, or if it is, I'll be ready and I'll have time and I can better prepare, or I'm always prepared, so I'll be okay with it. So I don't know if that answered your question. The other thing that was really challenging for me in this particular situation, I wish I had taken care of this before. 2 years ago, I was under a different health insurance. And so I had a provider that I'd had for, 15, 18 years. He retired. So then he passed me off to one of his colleagues in his practice. A couple months later, he retired. So then I met with another doctor in this group. And so I went from having the same doctor who knew everything about me to a doctor who barely knew anything about me to a brand new doctor within about 6 months. And then because of my job situation, my my health insurance changed, and they were no longer in network. And I didn't have the money to just continue visiting this medical clinic and provider out of network. So I had to find a new provider. Well, I'd had an accident. I had been going to see, you know, specialists like orthopedists and neurologists and that sort of thing. And so an occupational therapist and physical therapist. So I hadn't really needed a family practitioner or an internist for 2 years. And one of the things that delayed my ability to get help, even on the telehealth, was that I did not have a general practitioner or an internist who knew me. I didn't have a relationship with any clinic or any particular physician group. And I think that was a real misstep on my part. And I think it's made it much more complicated, because I would have been able to get in that first week and see somebody. And I probably would have been able to get in and get tested that first week when they diagnosed me with the upper respiratory infection or even the pneumonia and presumed COVID. I could have probably gotten an x-ray, and I probably gotten a nebulizer or maybe medications a little sooner. But again, you know, those are things that I didn't fully appreciate because I didn't think I needed it. So
hindsight's always 20/20, right?
Yeah. So I definitely think that those three things, you know, have a family doctor, establish a relationship, or at least have one where they have your information. You know, healthcare, even if you don't have a will or a power of attorney, have a healthcare directive. I've always had, you know, I have a living will. I've had one forever, but because my situation had changed, I needed to update it. It was 13 and a half years old. And so some of my wishes had changed because of things I'd experienced and things I'd learned. And so that, and then also the having your information. So in my safe and in my safety deposit box now, I have very detailed instructions and information about how to take care of things when I'm not here that are very separate from the will. You know, the will is more just whatever assets you have, but I mean, we're talking day-to-day practical things like, okay, you know, what kind of dog food does my dog need? What kind of medicines is my dog on? What kind of medicines is my son on? You know, things that I know it's locked in my brain, but no one else knows. And to try and cobble that all together in a stressful situation would be really difficult. And that would fall to, you know, you and my parents and extended family and friends. And I would never wish that on anybody. And so I really tried to think about, oh my gosh, this is horrible and this is difficult, but how can I help make it not so difficult if I'm gone? And nobody wants to have to do that. Yeah. And especially in a very ill, I mean, I was gravely ill. I mean, you can speak because I just know how I felt. And I have had surgery. I've had multiple very serious surgeries. I've had multiple illnesses and challenges in my life and a really severe accident. I'm used to doing what I need to do. I'm a really compliant patient and I'm like, I just do it. I'll get through it. I'll do what you tell me to do. I'll do it. But I've never, the only thing that I could compare this to is how scared I was is when I had anaphylaxis and thought I wasn't, I mean, I literally was not able to breathe. And that was very scary, but that was not even close to how scary this was because I absolutely did not know. And that's something I've never experienced before. And I've been really sick before and I've never been this sick for this long and in so many unexpected ways with so many different symptoms. I mean, I thought, okay, it's just going to be these subset of symptoms for respiratory and that's it. And then once I hit those, I check the boxes and I make it, I kind of level off. It's going to be no big deal. I'll be fine. I've got this. Everybody says you just get a mild case. It's no big deal. And that wasn't my experience at all.
Well, I think your story, what it speaks so well to is that, well, lots of different things. However, I would say, I hope that you're an outlier. I'm not sure. However, what you're sharing is so important, especially in terms of getting your shit in order. So many people, as a nurse for 22 years, nobody wants to talk about death. Nobody wants to talk about hospice or palliative care. And it's the things we absolutely need to talk about before we need to talk about it. So if you're hearing this and you're like, oh God, talk to an attorney. I'm sure there are lots of resources to facilitate and to help with this. And we have all this time, right? We have time to be able to talk to your family, tell them at a minimum, please share with your loved ones who you would want to have the information, what your wishes are. What would you want? Would you want to be on a ventilator? Would you want to be cremated? Like all the things that people avoid talking about, and it just creates more stress. So I cannot thank you enough for sharing that. And I know as a human, and especially as a person who is trained as an attorney, the need for control and certainty is immense. Mm-hmm. So I can only imagine the anxiety. So thank you for sharing that. So let's get to a couple more questions.
Oh, sure.
Are there any silver linings? I know you're still recovering and you're doing a phenomenal job, but is there a silver lining to your experience that you want to share?
So I love birthdays. I will be 50 next month. I am not embarrassed to say it. Birthdays to me are one of the greatest days of the year because it means you made it and you get another day at this thing called life. And so I was planning on having, you know, I have friends flying in. I was planning not a huge get together, but I was looking forward to it. You know, I mean, we all have ups and downs in life. And I really wanted to gather with my friends and my family and just say, you know what, I'm still here. We're all here and life is good. I try to be really grateful and have gratitude as much as possible because I don't want to be in a place where I think of the other things as much. And there were many nights, at least for a week to 10 days, where I didn't know that I was going to make it to my birthday next month. And I kept thinking, you know, I love birthdays. I love, you know, I want lots of them, you know, and I'm grateful for every single day, but I really don't want it to be this way. Like, I really want to have an extra couple of days to be with my friends and my family. And it's just, it really has reiterated for me how much our communities are and our networks are of our family and friends. You know, who we deem our real family, you know, isn't just your blood family, but your friends. It's you, they become your family. And so I had friends who I hadn't heard from in so long from all over the country. And I try not to post too much on Facebook, but I posted a couple things. And, you know, I asked for just, you know, just quick update. I've only updated 3 times this whole almost 50 days. And so it was a real blessing and a just an emotional and kind of spiritual kind of feeling to have, even though I was alone in my house. I mean, no one has been in my house since, I've been basically here since the 9th of March, and no one has come into our house since the 13th of March. And it's a pretty lonely experience. You know, it's just the 2 of us and our lovely dog, who's been by my side this whole time and has been really helpful emotionally. And I've had friends and friends, you know, families of Reese's friends, my sons, who have gone so far above and beyond and have been so selfless and so caring and so giving. And it's just been really amazing to see other people help. It's always been hard for me to accept help. And 2 years ago when I had my accident and suffered significant injuries and a very, very, very long recovery time. And again, zero lack of control, couldn't drive, couldn't do anything for myself for a very long time. I had to start asking for help. So fortunately that happened before this experience because I'm much better about it. But it still was just such a wonderful experience to have. Because I felt really lonely, you know. I thought, gosh, and you are so incredible and so amazing, but I didn't want you having to do everything, you know, because I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I want you to take care of yourself and your own family and not your business and your things. And so it was really amazing. I was just so pleasantly surprised for who showed up in my life in so many incredible and unselfish ways. And it just, again, going back to the birthday thing, and I try to be very grateful even on a bad day. And yesterday I was not having the best day, trying to find something. And it just really reiterated how damn lucky we all are to wake up the next day. And I've tried to live my life with more purpose and intention for the last couple of years and really focus on being healthy more so mentally and physically, and just really trying to be intentional about what I do and who I'm around and the actions I take and the things I do. And of course, this reiterated that even more. I'm even clearer than I already was. And I think I told you about an experience in my really darkest, most difficult nights. Nights are always the worst and have been for over a month. But I laid in my bed one night and I just kept saying over and over, you know, thinking about all the different people and their comments and their thoughts and the prayers and the warm vibes and the love they were sending. And I literally would just start at the top of my head and go all the way down my body that was very, very sick, and just go and almost like this golden rays of light. And I know it sounds so silly, but I just laid in my bed and kept saying these things over and over in my head, you know, to comfort myself. Because, and maybe I've read some people say there's hallucinations at some points, and maybe that's what I was doing. I don't know, but I feel like I was having a mindfulness experience and just a faith, you know, my faith experience, and just continuously focusing on that and you know, the meditation and the spirituality and just the positivity. I kept trying, and you talk about it a lot, because even if you don't experience, if you're not experiencing it, expressly experiencing it, you can be experiencing it internally. You know, it's that energy that you take in, and what you're willing to accept and what you aren't willing to accept in your life, energetically, as well as physically and emotionally and spiritually. And so I really, I tried as I got better to focus more on that. One of the things you and Mom continuously said to me was, stop looking at the news, stop reading the articles, you know, stop, because there were a lot of really scary pieces of information out there about what was happening. And I so desperately wanted information, and I could do nothing. I couldn't even sit up for a couple of weeks. I was so sick, and I didn't even have a TV in my room, and I didn't even turn on, you kept saying, just watch Netflix. And I was like, I can't read. I couldn't even focus. I was so sick on a magazine, which I love magazines, and, you know, certainly not a book. And so I just listened to meditation music. And eventually, after about 2 full weeks of the worst, I started watching stuff on my laptop when I could sit up. But I think it's those things, you know, the just kind of evaluation, once I felt a little bit better, and really being pleasantly surprised at the different people in my life. And it was as kind of sad and scary as it sounds. I was thinking, okay, if this is it, you know, I was doing a little bit of self-reflection about my life and the people in it from college and high school and living, you know, in Jackson, Mississippi and Memphis, and the people I've dated and the, you know, the various friends I've had at different phases of my life. And, you know, they live all over the world, and you don't get to see people as much, of course, as we all want to, but the connections that I've had, and some that are still there and some that are not, but being appreciative of all of them, even the ones that aren't here anymore. And what those relationships have taught me and meant to me, and you know, more about being intentional going forward. If I get to get through this, I kept thinking, if I get to get through this, these are just some things I want to do. And so it gave me a lot of clarity, I think, and incredible appreciation for all of my experiences I've had in these last 50 years, and what I want to do next. I'd say those are probably the biggest silver linings.
That is, sounds like a divine download to me, sister.
How apropos.
How apropos. So I think this is a beautiful way to wrap this up with a bow. And that is what I am witnessing. I always resonates or look for the silver linings. And if nothing else, this thing, I don't even like to use the words, because I'm all about very, and I have a lot of intention with my energy, which includes words. And that is that, you know, a crisis will bring out the best and bring out the worst in people. And you have been able to reconnect, recalibrate. And what you're experiencing to me is like a spiritual awakening, when you were feeling the light in your body. And even though I wasn't asking for stuff on social media, you better damn believe I had all my posses up in here, had all my Reiki masters, all my healer friends. They were all sending you the love.
I felt it. Yeah. Absolutely felt it.
So it takes a freaking hive. It takes a tribe. And I honor you for your courage, your vulnerability, because I know when you're a Wonder Woman and you can do it all, it's hard to ask for help. So I'm glad that you're allowing people to help you in the way that you need to be helped. And you're a badass. And so I think we should round this out with, what advice, what wisdom, as a warrior badass who has come out on the other side, would you share with someone who's going through it, who's caring for someone who's going through it, or someone who has fear about this?
I think that I would say, the more we touched upon it a little bit before, the advocacy piece, I think, is really important. One thing that you had encouraged me to do, and it's between you and having, you know, Mom and our, we are incredibly fortunate, because you are all educated in the medical profession. You all have such incredible training, and so many people don't have those resources. But even with those resources, having that on care and telehealth and this well loop to check in. I felt like I needed to be monitored. And again, I've been monitored every day since March 19th. And they said that that's what was necessary. So I would say if people do not have the telehealth connection or, you know, with a primary care provider, family practitioner, internist, whatever, that is checking on you, checking in on you, or you're able to log in. I mean, I literally just fill out a form every day and they either email me, text me, they'll post in our little login portal, or they'll call me if there are concerns. And so getting to talk to some, I don't get to talk to somebody every day, but getting that connection via text posting and sometimes those phone calls has really made a difference for me, and better understanding. And now that I look back through it, it's been really helpful for me. And I did create a spreadsheet, because once I finally felt better, I started tracking them in an actual spreadsheet. One of my really good friends, she and her husband got really sick too and did it. And I think it's important to share what you know. Again, as you said, this is not medical advice. This is not, you know, anything that anybody purports to say is going to definitely work for anybody else. This is just my own experience. But having information and sharing it, I think is really vital in talking to people who can help you. And some of the things that for me that I'm convinced saved my life are those connections with, you know, you and mom and, you know, dad and Ann, and this on care and telehealth stuff, but also the medications and saying, you know what, this is not working. What else can we try? You know, just really advocating for yourself. The other thing is to have hope, you know, whatever it is, you know, your faith, your hope, trying to stay positive. It's an incredibly grueling, nasty, mean, difficult thing. But try to have love and hope and faith and positivity. And, you know, I'm tenacious, and it's sometimes to a fault. It's sometimes it's my best and worst, I think, attribute sometimes. I don't like to back down from a, you know, from a challenge. And this one, I think you really have to be ready to go the distance and understand that there are going to be peaks and valleys in this process. I didn't appreciate that as much. I felt good for an hour and thought I was out of the woods or I was recovered. And then, you know, you feel horrible for the next 23 or the next 48. So just understand that that's from what I'm learning and what my own experience has been is not abnormal. The people, the doctors I've talked to, the medical teams I've talked to have said that's what they've seen a lot with this is the roller coaster. You know, people are lucky if they get out of this without, you know, a couple of days or 2 weeks. But to just hold on and having somebody is amazing if you're lucky enough to have somebody. I think isolating is really important. I know some people have done it at home and have been, there are a couple of well-known people who've been posting every day their experiences and things like that and isolating. And I think trying to, it's really hard, especially as a parent with young kids to isolate yourself, especially if you don't have another adult in the house. But I think it's really important to try to do that, even within your own household, if you can too. But I don't know. I guess those are the things that I would say. I'm sure, you know, the other thing they told me on Monday, they reiterated the whole time, but especially on Monday, was the trouble with this is there are a couple of parameters to guide the medical professionals, but almost every case is different. And that's something that's really, really difficult for the medical community and those of us who want some guidance and like a checklist or a, here's how long it's going to take. Do these three things and you'll be fine. Or if you don't do these three things, you're not going to be fine. And so knowing that your case, your particular experience is your own or your significant others or your family members or your friends. The other thing that I would encourage is if you're a friend or a family member of somebody who's going through it and you're not there, you know, video chat them. I mean, you and, you know, your husband and son, you guys were playing Scrabble and Uno and you would, you know, you would call me or video chat me. The video chats were really fun, you know, for even just a couple of minutes. And just to have that connection was huge for me, you know, right? I talked to, you know, Mom and Jerry or a friend would text. It was really hard for me to text or really talk on the phone. I couldn't talk. I don't know if you remember, Elizabeth, but I had no voice. and it was hard for me to breathe, and it would make me cough even more. And so a lot of times people aren't well enough to communicate in those normal ways. So, you know, just a text or a post on their Facebook or an Instagram or something, just checking on in on them. Because again, I think that one of the really difficult things with this is so isolating and so lonely and scary. I mean, knowing that you have to go drive yourself to urgent care and you have to drive yourself to the ER and no one can come with you. And it's not the typical approach when you're sick or you need care. Usually people have their significant other go with them, and they don't want that. They're discouraging that. And so any way that you can be there for somebody, just even a little bit, will hopefully make a difference. I have a dog, and so having my dog beside me, especially when I had to isolate from my son, he was the only real contact I had, and just having him next to me. So I know some people are fostering animals right now or have animals, you know, at home, and some of that little fur baby love is nice too, to have. I don't know if I answered your question specifically, but those are just some of the things.
Did. No, that's perfect. And so if somebody would want to pick your brain or ask you questions, would you be open to that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as I said, I think one of the most important things is sharing experience, because I desperately wanted information when I was trying to navigate this on my own. And there was so little information out there. I'm so glad so many more people are sharing their stories. But yes, I would absolutely be happy to tell people more about my experience. Perfect. Because there's a lot more. There's a lot more symptoms and a lot more, you know, there's a lot to talk about. And I know we've been doing this for a long time. And thank you so much for giving me so much time to do it. I think information is incredibly powerful. And I think that it helps. And if I could help one person that's going through this, or, you know, a medical person help a patient who's going through it, then it's all worth it. I mean, as I told you, I hope I took this on for all of our family and friends, and that nobody else has to go through it. I hope our state is so lucky and that so few people really have to go through this and people have minor symptoms. But I'm afraid there, you know, probably are going to be more people who are kind of somewhere in the middle of all of it, and I'd be happy to help.
That is awesome. Well, thank you for your generosity of your spirit and for sharing all of your experience, because this is absolutely going to help lots of people. What's the best way for people to contact you?
I would say email is probably the best.
All right. What's the email address?
Okay. It's Laura, and it's LARA, and then L, and then Overton, OVERTON at gmail.com. Laura L. Overton at gmail.com.
And what should they put in the subject line?
I think they should reference this Divine Downloads podcast.
Okay.
So that I know where it's coming from.
Perfect.
And I can set up a rule so that it doesn't end up in my spam.
Awesome. So I will put that email in the show notes. I also am going to put a link to a really great article penned by a nurse who she and her husband, who's an oncologist, also have overcome the illness. It's also another great, you know, how to manage COVID at home, because no one's really talking about that. So thank you for being willing to share your experience on this podcast, and for your tenacity. You're just amazing, and I love you.
Thank you. Well, oh my gosh, thank you for all of your help. I truly believe I would not have made it without all of your help and support and your nursing. You're an incredible nurse in person.
Awesome. Well, I wouldn't have it any other way. And with that, we are going to wrap this up. This is obviously a lot longer than usual. And
yeah, I think sorry.
No apologies. This is when, you know, this is a special circumstance, and I hope that people listen to every word. And until the next time, everybody, please keep, you know, being an advocate for yourself, get your things in order. And when we come out of this, we are going to be having so much more fulfillment and joy, right? For the little things we take for granted, like, oh, going to, you know, sit down to each with each other for coffee or a show or whatever it is. So thank you, Laura. And also thank you for the listeners. And if this podcast resonates with you in any way, please, for the love of all that is holy, share, because sharing is caring. We need to get more people listening, and take good care. Until next time, love you guys. Bye-bye.